You can probably think of lots of times you read a paragraph and realized that none of it stayed with you. Maybe you were sleepy or distracted. But that was a momentary lapse in reading comprehension. It's when comprehension is spotty on a regular basis that we get concerned, especially in young people who need to read and comprehend well to learn their lessons in school. Reading comprehension is a constant focus of the work of our first guest today. Once a month, we visit with a University of Oregon researcher in the segment we call Curious, where research meets radio. This month, we visit with Gina Biancarosa, the Ann Swindells Chair in Education and an associate professor in the Department of Educational Methodology, Policy, and Leadership. She also works at the Center for Teaching and Learning. Dr. Biancarosa, thanks for joining us today.
Good morning, Jeffrey. Thanks for having me.
I understand you got very close to a master's degree in English. What made you change course and head for the educational theory part?
Well, I was pretty young. I started the master's while I was still doing my bachelor's at Boston College and realized that it was really putting me on a fast track to a PhD in English, and I wasn't sure I was ready to commit to a road in life quite yet. And then as I took time to reflect on that, I realized that teaching literature to people who already love to read wasn't particularly challenging, but helping people who couldn't read, something that I love, would be much more rewarding to open up that world to them.
And there's a whole field here that, a term anyway, I'm not terribly familiar with, which is psycholinguistics. What is that?
Well, it's the sort of merging of educational psychology and linguistics. Linguistics is a very formal study of language, not just necessarily the English language, but all languages and its structures and affordances, including the sound systems that we use, the very sounds that come out of our mouths. Whereas cognitive psychology or educational psychology focuses more on thinking processes. And so psycholinguistics focuses on how we, as active agents, really tackle and learn language in both for speaking and listening, but also for reading and writing.
Is there a general assumption, Gina, that if reading comprehension is lacking, there's something mechanically wrong with the reading skills?
Well, that's been the problem that we've tackled most successfully in the reading field. There's always been a knowledge that there are readers who don't comprehend to the level that we would expect, but because the sources of reading comprehension difficulty are so diverse, it was a lot easier to tackle children who clearly struggled with just getting the words off of a page. But increasingly, researchers like myself are turning to the issue of readers who can read the words just fine, but aren't really comprehending as well as we would expect, or their comprehension is spotty, as you put it.
So you can read relatively well, but still comprehend poorly?
Yes, exactly, exactly.
So is there a perfect window in life in which to learn to read and comprehend well? I mean, I'm aware of some limitations in the brain with language at certain ages, but I mean, is there a sweet spot for learning reading and comprehension?
Well, it's a popular idea, even with learning language, that there's a sort of golden age at which to do it. But the truth is that, you know, our brains are very plastic, and you can learn language or learn how to read at really any age. It's just that it's a lot easier when you're younger because your brain is developing at a very rapid pace at that point.
All right. We're still building neural pathways at that point.
Exactly.
We're talking to Dr. Gina Biancarosa at the University of Oregon. She's the Ann Swindells Chair in Education and an associate professor in the Department of Educational Methodology, Policy, and Leadership, generally working on reading comprehension issues. This is our Curious segment, Curious Where Research Meets Radio, our monthly chat with researchers at the University of Oregon. Join the conversation, 800-838-3760, for things you've always wanted to know about reading comprehension, or you can send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. I notice you talk about facility with language and comprehension as fluency, and there's even a group called the Flunatics. Can you tell us about that work?
The Flunatics have folded up shop, but it was a group of researchers at the Florida State University and here at the University of Oregon who were interested in oral reading fluency, not as a skill in and of itself, but as an indicator of reading comprehension. And this is, again, something that we've known for a long time, that in general, the faster you read, the better you tend to comprehend. However, it's a lot more complicated than that. Obviously, you could imagine, just as we have speed talkers, I don't know if you remember the commercial.
The Federal Express guy?
Yes, exactly.
I've been compared to him many times.
Yeah, so there's a point at which getting faster doesn't get you more comprehension. And so this group, we were very interested in fluency as an indicator, or oral reading rate as an indicator of reading comprehension, and the sort of point at which it wasn't as valuable, but also the point before which it became valuable. There are some well-known floor effects with these things, where if someone's just not reading fluently at all, it's not really giving you an indication of how well they could comprehend, absent the issue with word reading.
So this must be a tricky zone to work, because, I mean, if a child struggles with just the sounding out of words and stuff, that's a pretty obvious set of issues you need to deal with. But if a child can get the word off the page, as you put it, and yet not hold on to it, wow, it seems like there's a whole broader realm of things you need to delve into there. Where do you start?
Well, my colleagues and I here at the U of O have been focusing on inference making, which is one of many sort of people group them very generally as executive function sort of skills, but it's the ability to sort of take in information and use it strategically, all the while sort of monitoring one's own understanding of the message of a text. And most of these processes are associated with the prefrontal cortex in the brain. And that's why it goes back into sort of early neuroscience, but that whole prefrontal cortex and all the processes there tend to get lumped as executive function, even though there are a number of different functions that are involved, both, including inference making, but also including things, like I said, monitoring, attention, working memory.
So on the inference-making part, I mean, this is an ability to take words on paper and get a sense of, I mean, it's almost like comparing it to something in your own life, isn't it? Or at least being able to understand how that would apply, the words that you see in front of you?
Yeah, sort of. That is definitely one of the ways in which we draw inferences. So one of the sort of famous examples is, you know, Toby decided he wanted to buy his mother a birthday gift. He shook his piggy bank. So why did he shake his piggy bank?
To figure if there was money in it.
Right. And so, yeah, you're drawing on your previous experience to make that inference. And for many of us, that inference is so automatic that even the question why he shook the piggy bank is sort of like, well, duh. But for some children, and actually for some adults, they are not automatically drawing those inferences. And truth be told, we don't entirely know if it's that they are not good at drawing those inferences, or if they just have a lower standard or expectation for what they should be doing and comprehending when they read.
Is some of that social or societal or cultural? I mean, honestly, I don't know any kid I've known recently who has a piggy bank, for example. I know we're being a little general here, but still.
Well, it's, you know, it is a bit of a mystery how this develops and whether it is specific to reading or not. My own focus is, of course, on inference making, but there are other things that could interfere. So, for example, let's say you're a recent immigrant to the U.S. and piggy banks weren't a thing where you come from, then the whole idea of a pig in a bank is almost irreconcilable, right? But, you know, in terms of, you know, an American child who has a piggy bank, it could just be that they're seeing reading as a very passive process. In fact, some would argue that it can be a side effect of a curriculum that's overly focused on getting the words off the page rather than also getting the meaning out of the text.
And so are there some general trends that you're tracking in reading comprehension?
Well, I haven't really delved into a longitudinal study yet, but the current work that I'm doing on an assessment of reading comprehension inferencing, we look cross-sectionally at grades 3, 4, and 5, and we certainly find that there are, we find more poor comprehenders, children who are not comprehending at the level we'd expect given their word reading abilities in third grade than we do in fourth grade, and more in fourth grade than we find in fifth grade. And there also seems to be a greater tendency among the younger children to rely on a strategy called paraphrasing, which is an excellent strategy. We all use it to comprehend, but it seems like they're sort of overly reliant on it, and we have a hypothesis that we have not tested, but that, you know, they're still kind of making that leap to actually making inferences, whereas the older children who struggle with comprehension are making inferences, but they're not so focused on the actual sort of narrative thread. So we think of them as lateral connectors because they're drawing all kinds of connections and elaborations, but they're kind of off to the side and not driving the narrative forward. So again, this is also a really important strategy that we all use when we read, but they seem to be over-relying on one or the other strategy and not necessarily sort of privileging what we call causal coherence when they read, which is building this sort of coherent image of what's happening in the story, as opposed to kind of staying bound at a lower level, a sentence level or paragraph level.
This is the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio. Dr. Gina Bianca Rosa is our guest in our research segment, Curious Research Meets Radio, with the University of Oregon, where she works on reading comprehension issues. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. It sounds like you've had to develop some rather rigorous tools to figure out where comprehension is falling down, but just the creation of those tools sounds like a very tricky process.
Well, it has certainly been a challenge, but a really intriguing one. You basically have to first define what it is you want to measure. And reading comprehension, as I said, involves a myriad of skills. And what we have found that children can do relatively well on one reading comprehension test, but not so well on another. And a lot of that has to do with how the different tests are defining reading comprehension. So for the measure that we're developing, we really want to define children who are having difficulty making these causally coherent inferences, the ones that sort of tie the story together in a meaningful way. And in order to identify what they were doing when they're not maintaining that causal coherence, we introduced what we call meaningful distractors. They're wrong answers that tell us something about what the child is doing when they're not getting the correct answer.
Oh, interesting. So you make some guesses about the ways in which they might make a wrong guess and provide it for them.
Exactly. So our wrong answers represent those two strategies that I was just talking about, the paraphrasing and sort of making these connections that don't drive the story forward but kind of go off to the side.
Wow. I noticed the title of a grant application from last year, Reading Minds, which obviously it's a good play on words in a couple of directions, but it seems like it would get really abstract, I would think, in differentiating between brain structures and use of brain, the mind, in other words, as in, you know, the mind is what the brain does, that whole thing.
Right. Well, you know, I have to say, from my own perspective, I'm less interested in brain structure than many others. I feel like that work has come a long ways, but more interested in sort of how brain imaging might help us to better understand what these poor comprehenders are doing. So, as I said, we don't entirely know if they're not, whether they're trying to make the inferences and just not succeeding, or if they're really just not even going there, not kind of going to that executive function center, let's say, but instead are just sort of very text-bound and sort of re-instantiating the text in their mind. And so neural imaging can help to distinguish that a bit, because if they are making inferences, you would expect more activity in that prefrontal cortex, whereas if they're staying pretty text-bound, you'd see less of that activity. However, if they are trying to make those inferences and they're just not succeeding, then you would expect the prefrontal activity for the paraphrasing children to actually be larger than or stronger than it would be for the children who comprehend well, because they're putting forth an extraordinary effort and yet not succeeding.
Oh, they're thinking really hard and not quite getting to the point they need to get to.
Exactly, yeah.
As far as the passivity part goes that you mentioned before, I mean, are these the students who were thinking, well, why didn't the story just say that? Is that the essence of where they're coming from?
I don't know. I you know, there's some indication that they just that there are some readers, and I would say this is a small number, but who just don't expect to understand anything from what they read.
Hmm.
And you know, sometimes you can really see that when you work with adults who are in basic education. They're so focused on just figuring out what those words are because that no one ever taught them that. You know, getting anything meaningful out of the text is a whole other hurdle that they have yet to jump.
All right. We have a call here from Marley in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Gina Bianca Rosa at the University of Oregon.
Hi.
Hi.
My thing is I had an aha moment this morning just before I was reading, and I'm definitely a strong I don't know if I'm a strong reader, but I definitely read a lot. In terms of comprehension, I may have some issues on that one. And sometimes I have to take quotes down in order to remember things and then go back over them over and mm-hmm. over again because I'll lose them. But this was interesting that there was a song I used to sing to my son when he was little, and I met up with it on 4th of July because I was going through a lot of music, and it was a Scottish song. And I'm reading books right now about the Hebrides and the Shetland Islands, and I came across two words today while I was reading an Anne Cleves book, and they were a butt and a bend, which was in that song that I read to my son when he was little. And it's the first time I've actually seen those used in print, because it's the first time I've read books about the Shetland Islands, which is kind of a root place because it's probably where a lot of my memories mm-hmm. are from, that part of the British Isles, and almost as if I have a craving for a place in my reading that makes sense to me. And sometimes the books I read, even the songs, rock and roll during the 60s, most people are very into it, and I'm not. I want to get into medieval things and things that are from very early on. But I think there's something to do with interest. That's why I'm making this comment.
Okay, appreciate it.
Oh, sorry. Marley, that's a really great point. Another really important source of comprehension in the reader is their background knowledge. And the fancy term we use to talk about it in my field is schema. And the way you talked about sometimes things just fitting in with what you know is sort of when you have a really richly developed background knowledge about a topic or an area or strong interests, also supporting that. It makes it a lot easier to build that coherent understanding of what you're reading. But, you know, I always kind of joke that, like, you know, you can make anyone a poor comprehender if you just give them something to read that they have no interest in and no background knowledge about. So for me, it might be something like theoretical physics or, you know, how to drive a truck.
We'll probably have a physicist on next month, yeah.
But for others, those would be very meaningful texts, although probably more so how to drive a truck for many people than theoretical physics.
So as you're working on corrective tools, I mean, beyond the assessment tools that you've created, what I mean, how do you to work to make corrections in once you realize what the shortfalls in comprehension are?
Right. Well, you know, I'm a strong believer in response to intervention, which offers sort of tiered intervention to readers. And I really think that what a lot of these struggling comprehenders need is to work sort of at tier two, which is sort of where they work in small groups with a teacher or a specialist. And what they need most of all, I would say, is discussion. There's some pretty strong evidence suggesting that while teaching strategies for reading, such as paraphrasing and making connections, can help readers comprehend, there's something about that, the nature of discussion that sort of, I think, helps to fill in the gaps of what they're understanding, as well as to give it some sort of authentic purpose. Like, I need to understand this so I can contribute to this conversation. There are actually some discussion interventions out there. There's one by Isabel Beck called Questioning the Author, but a lot of times those are used in large groups, and so your poor or struggling comprehender isn't likely to kind of pipe up and say, call on me out of 30 kids. They're going to let, you know, the kids who can do it easily kind of carry the conversation. So once you kind of put them in a small group where everyone is expected to contribute, it really gives them an authentic opportunity to practice these skills and to get better at them. And sorry, one thing, that the more expert the teacher, the more that she can sort of intuit, aha, this child is making connections, but they're not connections that are helping to fill in the causal gaps in the story that will help her or him understand why something is happening and what they're reading.
All right. So good assessment, obviously a key here, but also people who can help the child deliver better, somebody who understands what the child is struggling with.
Yes.
So what's we've got about a minute left. What's the focus ahead for your work in reading comprehension?
Well, I have been spending the last year learning about neuroimaging, but also about eye tracking. And my hope is to use these methods. Eye tracking is sort of using infrared cameras to see where the eyes are looking as they read, and triangulating that information with my assessment and some other assessments to see whether, in fact, these children are trying to make the inferences or just not succeeding, or if they have other issues going on where they're just not trying.
Wow, some really fascinating work going on there. Gina Biancarosa is the Ann Swindells Chair in Education and an Associate Professor in the Department of Educational Methodology, Policy, and Leadership at the University of Oregon. She also works at the Center for Teaching and Learning. Fascinating stuff. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Have a good day.
And you too.